Hello and welcome back to a Flatpak History of Sweden. We go through Swedish history one step at a time. And my name is Chris. This is episode 98. And about 2 meters away from me is Åsa.
I am indeed across the table from you. This time we are going to cover an event that is perhaps in the top 5 events of Swedish history in terms of how famous it is, but also for how instrumental it was in moving forward in the country's history. So much so that an entire film was released about this in January of 2024. But we'll get to all of that after we cover our Swedish phrase of the week, which this week is tack för maten.
And Åsa says that almost religiously every single day to me, but I also say it to her, but she usually says it first more often. We'll give the listeners a few seconds to guess what that is then. Tack för maten literally means thanks for the food. And you say it after you eat a lunch or a dinner. You don't necessarily have to say it to the person who cooked or served the food, as it's more like thanks for the meal time.
And yes, I say it after every mealtime, and I think most Swedes probably do. It's very ingrained in how we express ourselves, so much so that it is considered quite rude after having shared a meal to not say tack för maten, thank you for the food. And it's definitely something you teach kids. I remember when my brother's kids were little, if they sort of stood up or asked to leave the table, the adults around the table would go, yes, but what do you say? And then they were taught to say tack för maten.
Yeah, and I don't know about you, but at work we don't really say tack för maten when we eat lunch together if we're sort of, we all bring in our own separate foods. We might say tack för sällskapet, which is like thanks for the company. I don't think I've heard people at work say tack för maten.
Okay.
Do you say it at work?
Yeah, we say it at work, but definitely in that context, you're sitting down together, but you're not necessarily sharing the same meal. Everyone's sitting there with their own lunch food. Then I think it's more common to say, tack för sällskapet, thank you for the company, because sort of that's what you've shared. You've shared the company and not the food.
Yeah, you've literally not shared the food. But yeah. We also never say this at breakfast time, but that's not because you don't say it at breakfast. It's because we essentially never eat breakfast together.
I say it to myself at breakfast time or to whoever else might be here to have breakfast, but I don't say it to Chris because at breakfast time, Chris is still in bed sleeping.
Yeah, even though we get the bus together in the morning, I get up, have a shower, put on clothes and leave. And Åsa is up for a lot longer than that, mainly to eat breakfast, whereas I eat a little snack when I get to work. I'm not really a breakfast kind of person.
I think in all the years we've been together, we've never had breakfast together.
Yeah, we have breakfast at your parents.
True, true. That's quite important. You don't get out of having breakfast at my parents' house.
No, exactly.
My mother will kind of force breakfast on you. She's very concerned about the fact that you don't eat breakfast.
Mm. But anywho, let's go back to people who definitely had different breakfast habits. They didn't have overnight oats in the 1500s. So what did they do instead of eating overnight oats?
Yeah, although they might have had porridge, which is another one of my favorite breakfasts. But they're not having breakfast right now. In fact, we're going to return to quite a shell-shocked Sweden in 1520. It's a country Christian II has finally conquered. It's taken a fair few attempts and a whole bucket load of cash for the king, but he is now in command of the entire country. The Kalmar Union is once again back under one ruler. We saw last time how Sten Sture the Younger died at Slaget på Åsundens is, the battle on the ice of Åsunden, or sometimes just the Battle of Bogesund, named after the nearby town.
Yeah, and this time we actually are pretty confident in knowing how one of these rulers has died in the battle, because he got his leg blown off right at the start of the battle and right at the start of 1520. But by the time we reach the end of that year, his wife Christina has eventually given up Stockholm Castle after the siege there. Her defence of the city will lead to her getting a statue outside the modern-day Stockholm Castle a lot later on, which she obviously won't get to see, but we talked a little bit about that last time too. But now Christian is in charge, and he's going to be crowned King of Sweden too. He did head home to Denmark right at the end of the last episode and before this one, just to sort out a few things. He's there for a couple of weeks. But now at the start of this episode, he's back in Stockholm, and he's going to sort out a few things in Sweden too, that's for sure.
As Christian returns to Sweden, the Swedish nobility, military, and the remnants of the defenders of Stockholm are wondering what kind of victor King Christian is going to be. He is known to have a temper and a strong focus on getting what he wants. They're going to be quite anxious, I think, to see if Christian adheres to the terms of the amnesty he agreed with Christina at the end of the last episode. Hemingad had joined Christian's side, but convinced Christian to offer clemency to the Swedes who had resisted him, and Christina only surrendered the castle in Stockholm after getting this guarantee in writing.
So when she signed the amnesty and the surrender documents, Christine was looking forward to slinking away with the financial guarantees she'd received for herself and her family, and was probably planning to resettle at Tavastehus Castle in Finland, which she was allowed to keep. But when Christian returns, first she has to stick around for a bit, because after all, there's going to be a coronation.
Yeah, and we know those are fun. Usually, for some. Christian arrives happy for his coronation, and also happy that he's managed to fit in a quick visit to his pregnant wife back home in Copenhagen. He's also pretty happy at the fact that Stockholm is very much under new management now. There's a big sign as you enter the city, like, Stockholm, under new management. Before he left, he had replaced everyone at the Tre Kronor Castle and made sure loyal men were in charge of the defense of the city. He probably brought the key to the city with him that the city mayor gave him back in September, if he indeed carried it around with him. I'm not sure how keys to the city actually work in practice.
I mean, they're probably those giant joke keys that need like 3 or 4 people to carry. So if that was the case, he might have needed a whole gang of servants to carry this key around.
Maybe. He would also have been happy to see the city being tidied up, ready for the coronation. At this time, it is happening in Stockholm and not in Uppsala, as was previously the case. So the city has been in overdrive mode to get ready for the big day. After all, there had just been a siege, so there was tidying and repair works needing to be done. Along with the plans for the coronation, Christian is setting his mind to finally fulfill some of his longer term plans. Now Sweden is under his heel.
Yeah, because he's been a big player on the Scandinavian stage now for quite a while, listening and watching whilst his dad was doing stuff, and also been thinking for himself since he became King of Denmark. And he's turned his sights on Lübeck, and he wants to create a northern trading company that would rival the Hansa. And he planned it all out, thinking it was going to be a joint stock company with permanent shares and a dividend given out every 3 years. This really sounds like a modern sort of venture. He wanted to really try and redraw the political and economic map of the Baltic Sea. In this new venture, there would be offices and production sites in Copenhagen, Antwerp, Stockholm and Vyborg, and he would take over all of the trade in the east and in the Baltic Sea. To do this, he would claim all of Swedish copper, iron and silver mines to help fund it, and that would require a reorganisation of these mines under royal control, and he would also try and modernise them with techniques brought up from Saxony in Germany.
This is a huge deal, and part of this really grand plan that he has. Christian said after taking Stockholm that we have won one of the gates of Lübeck and it won't be long before we win the other, referring to the stranglehold the German city had over trade in the Baltics. Christian really wanted to change that now. There was a good quote about Christian's way of thinking here in Michael Roberts' book about this period that we mentioned in the previous episode, so we thought Chris will read the quote out for you.
The whole project was typical of that capacity for bold and imaginative thinking which gave Christian, in his better moments, an undeniable quality of greatness, a quality which is also displayed in his enlightened plans for social and judicial reform in Denmark. And there he's referring to the new university down in Copenhagen, for example, and among other plans Christian had for the main part of the Kalmar Union. And Roberts is right that Christian definitely does seem to have a streak of the grandiose about him, and he seems to be quite set on achieving these lofty aims too. But we'll soon see another side of him as we progress through this episode.
We shall, but first, it's coronation time! First up is the proclamation, which takes place on the 31st of October, where he is declared king by the people. This is something we've seen take place at Murastenar for the past 500 years or so, but nope, this time it was going to be done in Stockholm and near the Brunkeberg Ridge, of course the place where the original Stensture the Older, beat Christian's grandfather, the other Christian. So this is highly symbolic that it happens right there. Then on Sunday, the 4th of November, the coronation itself takes place. And again, it's not in Uppsala like previously. It's in St. Nicholas Church, where his father, King Hans, was proclaimed king before, and where the Brunkeberg Monument was located.
Some great and deliberate pieces of symbolism here. And an even bigger symbolic moment is when Christian gets a gift from his brother-in-law, who's the Holy Roman Emperor. And it's a chain of the Order of the Golden Fleece, which is the biggest honour anyone can get from the Holy Roman Emperor. And Christian was going to party anyway, but this just adds to the fun. And so now 3 days of party begin. Party time.
Party time, indeed.
I'm going to put in some, fireworks and cheering sound effects there, I think.
After the coronation, there was the traditional moment of the king creating new knights, or dubbing knights. Given that he had just conquered Sweden, though, Christian only dubbed Germans and Danes. There were no honours for the Swedes here. Instead, he particularly honoured those who had helped him in his victory, like his admiral, Søren Norby, and Otto Krumpen, who had led his forces at Åsundens Ice and helped defeat Stensture once and for all. So it was a real knighting, party mode, good times all around here.
But you know what, at most parties, especially I think when you're a bit younger, there's always one person who really doesn't want to be there but feels like they have to be because all their friends are going, so they sort of sit in the corner basically sulking away, determined to not have fun. And who was determined to be that person not to have fun at this party?
Well, that is of course none other than Gustav Trolle, who had been reinstated as Archbishop of Sweden by Christian. He is still extremely annoyed at his treatment at the hands of Stensture the Younger and the Swedish nobility. The fact that Stensture has been dead for a few months at this point has not really lightened the Archbishop's mood at all. The fact that Stensture has been dead for a few months at this point hasn't really done anything to lighten the Archbishop's mood. He's still annoyed at how he's been treated over the last few years.
Yeah, because after all, he was kicked out 3 years ago by both Stensture the Younger and a whole bunch of people from Swedish political society.
Yeah, so Gustav Trolle is holding a grudge here, and on the third day of the partying, he demands an urgent meeting with the king. The partying king moonwalks away from the dance floor, I imagine, and meets Gustav and some of his clerical buddies. Gustav hands over a document that is going to set in motion one of the most dramatic events in Swedish history.
Yeah, this is the title of today's episode, and like we said, probably up there in the top moments of Swedish history. So what does Gustav want with the king? Well, of course, this is still all about him. The document lists all of his complaints about his imprisonment, the destruction of his castle he had when he was archbishop, and all the events around him being deposed from his role as archbishop. And now, of course, he wants revenge and compensation. He doesn't want to hug everybody involved.
After reading the document and hearing Gustav out, Christian gathers the coronation guests to a great hall in the castle. If people thought this was just another part of the celebrations, they would have been a bit concerned to hear the doors to the room being closed behind them and then firmly locked. Gustav Trolle takes charge, striding forward, and begins to read from his document. It immediately becomes clear that this isn't a list of games to be played at the party. He is listing out a list of crimes and charging people who are in the room with having committed them.
And the crowd naturally react angrily, Christina Yelenhrana demanding he silence himself. But Gustav just kept going, accusing, among others, the mayor of Stockholm, the city council in Stockholm, assorted noblemen and women, 16 noblemen and 2 women, to have caused harm to the church and to him in particular. And Stenster and Christina are among those accused, even though, yeah, Stenster has been dead for a few months by now.
He can still be accused, apparently.
Well, I guess he still did commit the crime, but what's the point in accusing him? Anyway. And because these crimes were against him as archbishop, these are heretical crimes, and Gustav Trolle uses highly inflammatory language, invoking religious messages and declaring all those accused of being obvious heretics, because there's this difference between everyday crimes, which can range from everything from murder to stealing, or religious crimes, which was anything committed against the church or church people. Even if those were the same crimes, even if you murdered a priest, it would be religious people who would try you. And many of the accusations were actually financial, and Gustav Trolle wants compensation, up to 600,000 silver marks for himself and the previous Archbishop Jakob Olsson, which is an outrageous sum, and around 100,000 marks for church property and some extra bits too.
This is a big deal, and people understand why this is happening right away. Christian had promised political amnesty for those who opposed him, but this was a list of religious crimes, which should be tried by a religious court, aka by someone like Archbishop Gustav Trolle. And the sentence for heresy was death. It was a stitch-up. No promises made on earth are valid to those who are enemies of God, heretics. That's a whole different thing.
Yeah, and even though it's Gustav Trolle saying these things, the people in the room are suspecting that it might come from Christian, but Gustav Trolle is taking 150% of the credit for this. And those accused fight back, though, verbally. They discuss the actions of 1517 when Gustav was deposed, and the arguments continue long into the night. Christina herself thinks at one point that she has a magic ticket out of this mess. She produces a document, the Sammansvärning, or the Swearing in Common document, from the meeting back in 1517, where they all decided to remove Gustav. And remember, everyone present, peasants, noblemen, Stenstura, and even other religious figures like the Bishop of Linköping, Hans Brask, signed this document to say they all swore common responsibility for removing Gustav. Stuff. It wasn't just Stenstura who marched into the room and demanded he be removed. And this wasn't just a group of noblemen doing it. It was essentially everyone who was everyone in Sweden at the point at time in this meeting. And so what is Gustav going to do? Convict all of them? Christina's saying it was all of us who did this.
Well, you might be closer to the truth than you think. I just want to say for the listeners who want to remind themselves of what this swearing in common deal was back in 1517, we talked about that at length in episode 96, so just go back 2 episodes if you want to remind yourself. But when Christina produces this document, Gustav Trolle probably just smiled. This was a very big mistake by Christina. The document she mentions adds more names to his list of heretics, that crimes he is talking about weren't the same crimes as Christian has given amnesty for, and now her whole ploy is backfiring. By papal law, heretics' close associates are also guilty by association, even those who didn't directly take part. So that meant that pretty much all of the estates were guilty. So, oopsie.
All four parts of the Swedish parliament and governing process are now guilty of removing Gustav Trolle.
One person quickly sees the writing on the wall, and that is Hans Brask, Bishop of Linköping. He demands for his seal on the sammansvärjning document, on the swearing in common, to be removed. And what do they find when they remove the seal?
Well, we mentioned this back when covering it, because Hans Brask has written a note to go along with his seal, which said, "Här till är jag nöd och tvungen," which means, "Here I am forced and compelled to do this." And so, yeah, this is saying he didn't want to do this, and so that means Gustav says, okay, well, you know, you're not just saying it now when I've caught you in the act, but you actually wrote it at the time, so he lets him off. And this leads to the phrase brasklapp, which is a bonus Swedish phrase of the week, can you say?
Yes, because from this very event, we get the Swedish term or phrase brasklapp, brask's note, and it means when you kind of make your reservation to something known. So say, for example, you're in a meeting at work and everyone else thinks that it's a great idea that you
buy a new printer,
for example, but you think a new printer is a waste of money, so you will say, "Well, I would like my brasklapp put into this." Or it can also be used, for example, when deciding something, but you're wanting to interject, sort of like, "Oh, but if we do that, this might happen. You know, we'll still do it, but just be reminded that this could be a consequence." Then you could say, "Yeah, sounds good, but a brasklapp to that is that, actually, if it rains, then that's not going to work out. But sure, let's go with it anyway."
But all of this means that Hans Brask is perhaps the only person on the evening of the 8th of November who's feeling a little bit relieved. The rest of the accused are kept in the castle overnight and are awaiting this religious trial to happen. And this is one that Gustav Trolle is keen to have as soon as possible, so that means the next morning. And there are so many of these prisoners kept all over the castle, they had to be put in the towers, in the chapel, and anywhere where there was space. Outside, Christian's heralds went around the city, proclaiming a curfew and forcing people to go home. The people realise something pretty dodgy is up, though, because this isn't a normal occasion.
So the very next day, the accused are brought before the court. There are 14 priests and a bishop on the court. Actually, the court includes the newly acquitted Bishop Hans Brask. So talk about going from one extreme to the other right away, going from being accused to sitting on the court. And even more outrageously, Gustav Trolle is also one of the judges. He's the one accusing everyone, so this seems extremely unfair, and of course the accused protest. How can he be both judge, jury, and prosecutor?
It doesn't matter how, though, because Christian isn't going to lift a finger. It's a religious court, and so he watches on at this quick display of what is assumed to be justice. The trial was over very quickly, and surprisingly, all were found guilty and then sentenced to death. And it was to be carried out as soon as possible, too, just like the trial. They're even committing to death two bishops who signed the sammansvärjning along with Hans Brask.
Wait, let's just pause a moment to take stock. Gustav Trolle has just convicted and sentenced to death over a dozen noblemen and religious leaders of Sweden because they kicked him out as archbishop 3 years ago. As those accused were probably also thinking at the time, maybe this was just going to be a bit of a show-off of who is now boss, but nothing will actually come of it. But no, he was deadly serious. The accused appealed to Christian, but he washes his hands of this and say it is a religious matter. It is Gustav Trolle who is convicting them, not him as king. He does nothing to stop this process. In fact, he says to others gathered that if you complain, you will join them.
And this is all happening in a flash. There's no time to think or protest properly. And before long, the main square in Stockholm was filling with people. Guards, spectators, prisoners, curious onlookers, maybe the odd pig. And some of the prisoners still held out hope that this was actually just still some elaborate show of strength by Gustav Trolle and Christian. And if they let off a big plea and please help us, save us, we swear we'll listen to you, that they would then be let off and everybody could see that Christian and Gustav Trolle were in charge. But these thoughts swiftly went away as they were being dragged towards the execution site outside. Their hopes there were dashed even further. They were led towards the balcony of the city hall, where councillors from Sweden and Denmark stood, looking down at the unlucky men and the thronging crowd.
A proclamation was read out by one of Christian's new Danish knights, explaining to the city what was about to happen. You can imagine the commotion as he realized this was really going to happen. The Bishop of Skara, one of the accused and sentenced, was outraged and shouted and screamed at the injustice of the event. He called the court and the sentence a joke, but Gustav Trolle just stood there and smiled wryly. So first up was Matthias of Strängnäs, a bishop who actually, just a few months before, was a key figure in the Swedish council, arguing for the country to make peace with Christian and submit to him. It didn't do him any good now, though. Even people who had switched sides in the last months of the conflict and started supporting Christian, like nobleman Erik Abrahamsson Leijonhufvud, they were executed because they had been on the sammansvärjningsbrev, on the swearing in common.
Matthias of Strängnäs was executed along with the Bishop of Skara and their heads chucked into a barrel. Up next were 15 noblemen, executed with a sword, as was their right as nobility. I'm sure they loved the fact that they got killed by a sword rather than hung or anything else. This included Christina Gyllenstierna's two brothers and Gustav Vasa's father and Måns Green, who was the nobleman who'd advised Christina during the siege of Stockholm Castle. So these are big people. These aren't just your random noblemen. These are all very important people. And a bit of a side note quickly, if you remember, Gustav Vasa was one of those taken hostage by Christian a few years previously, and now his dad is being one of the people killed. And he'll hear the news of the death of his father and everyone else, not in captivity in Denmark, but from elsewhere, because he's in the meantime escaped Danish captivity and will understandably be rather annoyed at his father's execution. He'd be even more annoyed when he found out that his father was actually about to miss the whole thing, as he arrived at the castle when the gates were locked and the meeting was taking place already. But he insisted on being let in, only then to be taken captive and executed among the rest. So if he'd just not been that bothered and went home, he might have managed to avoid it. But yeah, more on the Vasa family later on, as there are more executions to come. They're not standing around talking like we are. They're continuing with the delivery of death.
Indeed, in the most gruesome way, heads are flying here. In total, 6 councillors of the realm of Sweden were killed, and the barrel now is about to fill up. Blood starts flowing through the square around the onlookers as it starts to also rain. It's a horrible scene. Up next were the lesser important but still prominent figures from Sweden and Stockholm. The mayor of Stockholm is among the dead here in this round. Some people were even dragged from their homes on the same day and brought to the main square. Some of these lower men were hung, some were beheaded with an axe, but the result was the same. There was more death and more disbelief from those next in line and those watching it.
And speaking of people watching it, one man was so upset and distraught at the scene around him that his emotional reaction was taken for sympathy with those being executed, so he was just put in line and dispensed with too. There shouldn't be any pity shown for these traitors, or for these heretics to be more precise. You need to get rid of them all for going against the church and God. Although actually there was one person spared, and this was a man so fat that they couldn't hang him properly, so he was let go, and he even went to become mayor of Stockholm, so that was a pretty lucky chap.
There was actually incentive for Christian to let this whole thing get a bit out of hand. His soldiers were going around the city just confiscating property and buildings from those killed and keeping it for the king. This should actually have gone to the church, since this was a clerical trial, and they, if they wanted to keep up the pretense of this being a religious court and execution spree, they should have taken the loot. But King Christian isn't having any of that when it comes to getting some free stuff off of the back of this.
And he's trying to be absolved of all blame, but also reap the political and economic benefits of the bloodbath. Because as the second day of the violence begins, there are more and more burghers from Stockholm and around Sweden killed. People that didn't have anything to do with the removal of Gustav Troller. They are clearly being targeted through opportunism, and only Christian can do this and then take their stuff. He's really jumping on the bandwagon here. And between 80 and 120 people are killed on these 2 days, with a lot of people saying it's closer to 80, but there aren't really reliable efforts made to keep up with the extrajudicial killings as the violence started to spiral out of control. The main executioner, Jörgen Holt, said he chopped off at least 82 heads, so that's a figure quoted by some, but we know some people were hung too, and even the servants of those executed were put to death. So are these higher numbers, do they include the servants, or are they just the regular people? If you do include the servants, how high does the number go? So yeah, that's why there's a bit of a question mark around these numbers. And the bodies, all of these dead people, are sorted into three piles because, you know, that's something you should do. And the men of the church had their own pile, and then the noblemen, and then the burghers. And they were left on the square there for days. Nobody was to touch them.
The women involved in this story, including Christina, who has had a very important role, they were spared the execution axe or sword, but they were imprisoned, and some would remain imprisoned for many years. But at least they weren't killed. This is likely due to the chivalric ideals of the time and sort of like cultural ideas of how much agency women had and so on. So the women weren't killed, but they were definitely imprisoned. There are various stories about what actually happened with the sentencing of Christina and her mother in particular. Some say that she got a choice. Did she want to hang, drown, or be buried alive? But that she fainted and Christian pardoned her. Personally, I think that's likely invented much later on as a story. I'm generally very suspicious whenever I come across a source that claim that women fainted in history. Fainting aren't actually that common, and it's often used to sort of portray women as weak. Other sources say that Christina's mother was sewn into a sack and only then pardoned. That's a bit of a weird thing, but maybe that happened. In the end, Christina and her mother were sentenced to death, but Christian then converted it to imprisonment. It was quite common for women to not be executed, like we said, so this wasn't unusual or, you know, a grandiose expression of kindness from King Christian. But the fact that Christian is pardoning them just adds to the confusion of the event, because how can he pardon something as king when this is supposedly a religious trial where the archbishop is in charge? So yeah, it just muddies the water further.
Yeah, and we'll return to some of that later on. And as you can probably tell by the random piles of bodies on the main square, there wasn't a plan in place for what to do with them. So on the 10th of November, there's a royal order to take the bodies to Sir de Malm to be burnt on a giant bonfire as what should happen to heretics. The soldiers even dig up Stensturer the Younger and his young baby's bodies and burn them as well. This is a full stop at the end of the event, punkt, as you would say in Swedish, and it's a brutal end at that.
Yeah, just the fact that they dug up the baby as well, the baby that Christina had lost whilst being commander of the defence of Stockholm a few months earlier, that just seems sort of needlessly ruthless. What is interesting is that Christian himself is not there to witness these acts of cruelty. After getting the news of what has happened, the process of explaining himself and the actions of Gustav Trolle, they begin to occupy the king's mind almost immediately. He knows full well that this event will send shockwaves around Sweden, Scandinavia, and Europe. It is a brutal crackdown, with bishops, councillors, nobilities, and mayors all being killed in a 24-hour, brutal, remorseless act of violence. So he needs to manage the PR of this event right away. First of all, Christian writes a quick letter to the Pope, making up a story as to why this was all really necessary. After all, two bishops had been killed, so the Pope is going to want to know why. So Christian claims that there had been an assassination attempt against him and that the two bishops died in the violence of that, which is obviously bogus. The Pope, of course, didn't believe this. He wasn't born yesterday, and there had been many witnesses to what actually happened in Stockholm. The name Bloodbath, by the way, was first used by Christian himself in a second letter to the Pope.
Yeah, which is why we call this now the Stockholm Bloodbath, which is the name of the episode. Christian also writes a similar letter to people around Sweden trying to save face, and he's saying that he saved the country from being excommunicated, that this had to happen as the church had convicted them, so he had to help fulfill the religious verdict and he couldn't do anything to stop it. And this starts a debate, or continues a debate, that's still going on to this very day. Who was responsible for the bloodbath? Christian, Gustav Trolle, or a combination of both of them? And we're going to spend the rest of this episode putting forward the various arguments and see if we can come down on one side or the other. But don't get your hopes up, because as one historian has noted, possibly no event in Swedish history has been subject to more prolonged controversy, apart from maybe the death of Karl XII. And so let's see what these various points of view are.
I think we should start by looking at the process itself. As Michael Roberts and many Swedish historians discuss at length, it is all very irregular. If this was a heresy trial, then it violated canon law at almost every point. Roberts suggests that Gustav Trolle just wanted money and revenge. For example, he didn't include some of his political enemies who he had actively complained about in Rome, but he knew they had little money, so what was the point of including them? But instead, he did include people who were apolitical or not directly involved in the decision to remove him simply because they were wealthy and he could take their stuff. It also didn't make sense because two other bishops who did sign the 1517 sammansvärjning weren't only not executed, they were actually judges in the trial. So if the sammansvärjning was the main piece of evidence, why weren't they included? So yeah, this idea of collective punishment for everyone doesn't really work, but maybe it's more likely that it was Christian himself pushing this act and using Gustav Trolle and his pliable rage and money-grabbing desires as a handy excuse and a way to get away with it without having to literally hold the knife himself.
And indeed, and the fact that some bishops are killed at all is also a strange part of the proceedings, and this really stirs up trouble. The trial also comes to a very quick verdict for something so important and radical, and it's disputed who is given their authority for the trial to go ahead. Who are they acting on the behalf of, apart from, of course, Gustav Troller himself as Archbishop? But apart from the strangeness of the proceedings, who was behind this then? Let's try and talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so like we said, you can split the thoughts on this into three camps in terms of who was in charge. Was it Gustav Trolle? Was it King Christian? Or was it a mix of the two? Let's go through them in no particular order, starting with Archbishop Gustav Trolle. He had only been archbishop for a relatively short while, having been reinstated when Christian took control of Sweden. Ever since Sten Sture deposed him and destroyed his castle, Almaresteket, he has been, it's fair to say, annoyed. His rage and determination, plus his vigor in pursuing the death penalties against all presidents, well, shows that he had a major role behind the whole thing.
It was Gustav Troller who went after everyone he thought had wronged him, and he was a young, angry man who kept grudges. He was the one who presented the claims to Christian during the party and helped preside over the court along with a Danish bishop. Once the verdict was put forward, Christian simply just had to follow along. It was a religious court, and so a mere king can't go against the findings of a religious court. He just had to carry out the sentence and help the church carry it out. We've seen Christian and other Danish kings deal with rebels throughout Swedish history in a swift and brutal way, and Christian will continue to use harsh methods against the people of Sweden in the next few months. So this shows that if he'd wanted to kill all these noblemen and burghers, he could have just simply done it. He didn't need the pretense of a religious trial to try and save some of his face, because he's just happy murdering people anyway. Why? What's the point in trying to pretend this is a religious trial? So that points to the fact that maybe it was Gustav Troller, because Christian would have just stabbed them in the face and just said, oh well, he died.
So surely that means that Gustav Trolle was the man behind it. He was wronged to begin with, he was angry and vengeful and instigated the whole proceedings. He wanted money and compensation and, most importantly, yeah, revenge. This was the way for him to get that. Christian could and would get revenge in other ways, but this was the way for the archbishop to remove his enemies from the game.
So that's the case with Gustav Troller, but what about Christian? He certainly has motive. The bloodbath conveniently served two purposes for the king. It got rid of anyone loyal to the Sture family and anyone who was anti-union. As a bonus, by cleaning out the Stockholm burghers, he severed many of the connections and loyalties to the Hansa. This gave him an almost completely clean slate for him to start his own trade system and northern trading company, something that he's been dreaming of for a while now. It certainly helped that his soldiers were rounding up some of the victims and plundering their homes. As a result, he even managed to get his hands on the gold crowns of King Eric and Queen Philippa and took them home for himself.
That's not the reaction of a pious king, just doing his reluctant duty to God and following his archbishop's advice. That's very much the reaction of a king acting on his own. The fact that the killings start to spiral out of control also helps Christian. There are people killed who had nothing to do with removing Gustav Trolle or even really resisting his invasion. It was just a convenient way to kill more people who might stand in the king's way and blame it on the church. We know from the past and from future events that Christian doesn't shy away from killing people. It is just that this time he has a decent alibi and someone else to blame it on. He takes advantage of this and targets the entire Sture family, including Christina, her mother and brothers, for example.
Christian's dad and grandfather spent their entire reigns facing Swedish rebels, essentially, so Christian has a clear motive here. Get rid of any rebels before they can even appear. As Robert says, the continued atrocities which accompanied the king's journey throughout his kingdom after this event are certainly in part Christian's own responsibility, and may be taken to suggest that the Stockholm bloodbath was either part of a deliberate system of terror designed to pulverize all opposition, or the manifestation of an acutely psychotic personality.
A psychotic personality is certainly something people put on Christian, and he will soon get given the nickname Tyrant. That's a relatively tough name to get, but Christian does his utmost to live up to it. Historian Lars Olof Larsson believes the bloodbath is definitely Christian's idea. He just gets others involved as his accomplices and eggs on Gustav Trolle, knowing he can use him as a scapegoat in the future. There's correspondence between Gustav Trolle and the king during the spring and summer before the bloodbath, and in that correspondence, they're discussing harsh punishment for those who stood against the archbishop, so Christians shouldn't be surprised at the outcome. He is actively pushing for it.
Plus, there are many people who were killed who had nothing at all to do with removing Gustav Trolle. It's a nice, easy way for Christian to strengthen his control over Sweden, something we'll see him continue to do in the next episode. And so there is also people who argue that even though, you know, it was a religious court, Christian, if he really wanted to, could have sent in his soldiers to stop the massacre and just given people a bit more time to think about it and then convince Gustav Trolle he was getting out of hand. But he doesn't even attempt to stop this because in reality he was probably the one behind it.
Indeed, so whilst Gustav Trolle is certainly not an innocent man in the process, Christian has the most to gain and pushes the event from judicial extremes to an utter massacre. He has the will, the reason, and the attitude to do it. He's going to hope now that he has full control of Sweden and keep hold of it, something his father and grandfather were never able to do, actually. And it seems likely, as almost the entire Swedish nobility and most leading members of the council are killed, that he can actually do this.
And this is perhaps another reason why it wasn't Gustav Trolle behind things, because it's not like he's desperate to get this money and compensation and stuff, like, right now. Obviously, he wants revenge and he wants, in his eyes, justice and the money. But he's now going to be archbishop in a country where there's no opposition, so he doesn't need the money right away. He's got a whole future career ahead of him to now hoover up money and take back these positions because his ally is now king in Sweden. So he doesn't have to go this far and this desperate if he doesn't want to.
So we'll have to see how King Christian intends to use the advantage of his strong position next time.
That means we'll pick up the story next time in episode 99, the last one with only two numbers in the title.
Oh, wow. Episode 99. Who would have thought? We hoped you enjoyed this episode, if you can say that, about a bloodbath. But it was certainly a fun and interesting one to research, again, if you can use that word about such atrocities. This really is one of the most famous moments in Swedish history, and hopefully this gave you an understanding about why. The story will continue in a very dramatic way, so make sure to tune back in next time as we keep telling the story of Sweden one step at a time.
In the meantime, you can support the podcast in all the regular ways and visit our social media or website if you want to find out more.
Yes, so for now, just take care and see you next time. Bye-bye.
Hej då.